Okay, hello and good morning and welcome to Concurrent Session 5A, the case against government support of a lifetime annuity market in Australia. Today our speaker is Barry Rafe. Barry is an actuary who has spent most of his career as a management consultant. Barry is currently the Senior Vice President of the Institute of Actuaries and is studying for a PhD in philosophy at Sydney University. Barry has been the editor of Actuary Australia and is the facilitator of the professionalism course for newly qualified actuaries. Barry also used to be my boss, and I have embarrassing footage of him doing breakdancing, which will go onto YouTube shortly. So please welcome Barry Rafe.
Thanks, there. And the reason I look a bit startled, actually, I forgot I was doing this session. So after all the excitement this morning, Darren grabbed me outside and said, you know, we should get in there and start talking. And I'd completely forgotten about it. But anyway, I got my notes and everything, so I'm right. This paper was a bit of a rant, actually. I was getting concerned at the time. This is about 3 to 6 months ago. There was quite a big push for the government to make annuities compulsory. And I think it sort of came to a bit of a head at the ASFA conference in Melbourne. And there are a few industry players there that were promoting products and things. And so this paper was really a response to that sort of push. And I don't think, I mean, you'll see from here, I don't think the government should be providing overt support for a lifetime annuity market. And since I wrote this, the Henry Review has come out, and it's saying a similar thing, but it is actually proposing some changes that would make the annuity market deeper. So that's really the background for this paper. Now there is a genuine concern. In fact, it's sort of a bit of a theme for this conference is the question of longevity and how we protect against that. And you think out of everybody in the community, it should be the actuary that's got that sort of front of mind and can come up with a product that can protect against longevity. So there's obviously a genuine concern. And even if these products could be efficiently produced, on the face of it, they don't really appear to be a good investment. And there's a number of reasons for that, which I'll go through. Some of those really are just, it's probably the first time a person ever sees what the cost of paying for their retirement is, and that puts them off psychologically. I also want to thank Darren. Darren was also the peer reviewer on this paper, as well as being chair of this session. Now, I'm not talking about health costs in this session either. It's really just the income part of it. Health is a completely different issue. Obviously, just as important. Now, there are lots of reasons why people will outlive their retirement benefit, their retirement savings. They save too little. They retire too soon. They spend too much too soon. They stuff up on the investment strategy. They live longer than expected. The products they buy are inadequate, or the institution they buy them from goes bust or becomes insolvent. And if you're sitting in Greece and you had a government-guaranteed pension, and you just had suffered a 20% decrease in that, these things happen, and they happen in cycles. So my particular focus in this paper is longevity risk, and it's funny calling longevity a risk given it actually seems like a good idea that we can live longer than we expect. We can do more things. And so what I'm really referring to here is the financial risk of living too long, not some of the other social and economic risks of living too long. And if you look at it from a financial perspective, and if you take a public policy perspective, so if you're sitting at the government's perspective, you can see that pooling retirement funds is actually a much more efficient way of paying for retirement than expecting everybody to pay for their own. Because if you're an individual, when you want to work out the probability that, you know, 90% chance that you don't run out of money, then you need quite a big pot of money to cover that risk. If you're looking at it from the government perspective, that, you know, they don't want people to run out of money, they only really need to work on a 50% probability rather than a 90% probability, because if it's your money and you die early, you don't get the, you know, what you leave behind doesn't get redistributed. Whereas if you can pool everybody's funds, and obviously there is a redistribution. So from a public policy perspective, you can actually make a good case for somehow pooling people's retirement assets. And this, I think this is one of the challenges for government, and I haven't really got any specific answers here. But I just want to point out, I suppose, that I don't think that making lifetime annuities or even overtly supporting them is the way to go. And it was interesting, I meant to mention actually in the session this morning that survey, there are one of the questions was about whether the government should provide longevity risk for annuity providers. And I think about 47% of the people who responded said they should, which is sort of what I'm calling here overt support for an annuity market. So why is it that these lifetime products are unattractive? I mean, there's almost none sold. There's only really one provider that sells lifetime products. There are other people coming onto the market, but it really has not been a big marketing success. And some of the reasons are things like loss of capital on premature death. Now, obviously, you can buy products that compensate for that, but you forego income if you do that. The perceived poor return on their investments. So when you buy these products, the return doesn't look that good. On the face of it, doesn't look that good. Annuity income streams often don't match the needs of the retired. So when I retire or when I rebalance my life, I go through stages. So it's in the first 10 or 15 years I want to be out there doing stuff, and as I get older and frailer, your income needs drop down as you get older, but with an annuity product, obviously that doesn't quite match that. You can obviously buy annuity products that sort of just give you a base load, but certainly the annuity products themselves don't necessarily match the lifetime needs. There's a really high timing risk, and I suppose one of the themes that comes through this as we go through the paper is I moved from a discussion on government compulsion into a question around how do we buy annuity products anyway. I've got a real problem with the whole systemic question about buying annuity products, which will be an interesting discussion to have when we get the regulator here this afternoon. But there's a high timing risk. If I had bought a product this time last year versus this time this year, then there's no way that I can hedge the interest rate changes. Once I've bought the product, I've bought it, and I've got no choice about that. And the other thing is the disappointment of longer life, which really is this question I mentioned before, that the reason that annuity products on the face of it look like poor investments is because that's probably the first time you've ever been confronted with the true cost of your retirement and the true cost of how long you're going to live, how much future inflation protection is going to be. So annuity products, even very efficiently built annuity products, don't look like they give a particularly good return. And I've attached to the paper, I've provided a number of ways of hedging some of that longevity risk. But the ways the government could support the annuity market, given that that's the way they think they should do it, is firstly they could make purchase of annuities compulsory for everybody. And all of a sudden, I mean above certain asset levels, all of a sudden you would then trigger the need for wealthy people to buy annuity products. So that would be a big boost for the market. And they could either do it by buying the age pension, so you can sort of pay the government money to up the age pension, or they could do it by just making it open to the private sector. So the private sector would get sort of big transfer of capital from wealthy individuals into life office balance sheets. Another way the government could support the market is the hedging of longevity risk. And I've got this view. I mean, I was at an interesting session yesterday where they looked at the past trends of annuity improvement. And I think that the average annuity improvement for a male was about 2.5 months per year for a male over age 65, which I actually thought was probably higher, a lot higher than I expected. And that's assuming a past trend. Now, if we get some sort of major improvement in health, cancer thing or a heart thing, then you can actually imagine that we can get some quantum changes in longevity. So the longevity risk is actually where I think the biggest risk is for an underwriter. But what the government could do is provide the government could underwrite that. They already underwrite it through the age pension. They could underwrite it through life insurance, through products available for life offices. As you know, with longevity risk, there's two components to that. One component is I live longer or shorter than the average, and the other component is that the average increases. and me living longer and shorter than the average is something you can insure against. But if the average increases, that's not something you can insure against directly, because it's basically affecting everybody. But obviously, if the government did provide a hedge for longevity, then there'll be a price for that. And if the price is, if it's priced theoretically correctly, then whilst there might not be a capital requirement for that for life insurance companies, there'll still be a price built into the annuity product you buy. The government could provide a hedge against long-term inflation and longevity risk. So that's sort of just an extension of the previous one. The government could allow foreign annuity providers to enter Australia. So the discussion I was at yesterday showed how in England they've got quite an active lifetime annuity market, and the prices vary by postcode because there's quite a strong economic correlation between the economic status of the individual and UK, similar to us. That's also driven by postcode. So if we allowed foreign players into Australia, then they would be able to leverage bigger balance sheets, more experience, and more critical mass. But I just can't see how that would happen. I mean, the regulator wants to regulate financial risks in Australia, and I can't see how they'd allow a foreign player to come into Australia, even though they've got good product skills, without actually having a balance sheet in Australia that we could regulate. So I can't see how allowing foreign players into Australia would be acceptable to the regulator. Or the government could allow annuity products directly by buying them off of them. So you could go to the government and for $100,000 buy an extra bit of age pension. But you get the issue there with impaired lives and selection and that sort of thing. So that's probably not a good way of doing it either. Or they could support the market indirectly by giving tax penalties on lump sums that aren't used to buy annuities and that sort of thing. That creates distortions, but that's another way of creating the market. So that's sort of discussion on how they could do it. And so the reasons why the government might want to do that, as I have argued before, there are actually quite strong efficiency reasons for the government to support a lifetime annuity market. People will underestimate their life expectancy, and people need support on that, and a lot of people will probably drop back on the age pension. 75%, I think, was a projection that Henry made, or it's certainly in the... I think it was in the Henry report that 75% of people would be on the age pension anyway, going out 20 or 30 years. So we're really only talking about the 25% or so of people that aren't falling in that range. So from the community's perspective, there's a strong economic argument to pool post-retirement monies. But I think there's a stronger reason why the government shouldn't support the annuity market. In a compulsory market, it'll be the very wealthy that are actually dominating this market. Obviously, if you've got, I've done some sort of back of the envelope calculations here, but obviously to be a compulsory market, there would have to be compulsory above a certain asset level. So the asset level to give you a decent pension would have to be, you know, $500,000 or $600,000 to buy a pension. You'd expect that people would be allowed to have $1 or $2 million in lump sum. So you're actually looking at quite a small market of people who've got accumulated assets of more than $3 or $4 million anyway, if there was to be a compulsory market. And if the government were to underwrite longevity, then effectively what the government's doing is they're providing a... And if more wealthy people live longer than lower wealth people, which seems to be the sort of trend, that is actually quite a big subsidy going from the poor to the wealthy through underwriting annuity products. And it just seems perverse to me that the government would want to be in a position where there's that subsidy going forward. So the bottom line of this then really is that my view from a government perspective is that because most people are going to fall within the age pension anyway, the government's already carrying that risk. They shouldn't also carry the risk for the wealthy, who should basically be able to look after themselves. Anyway, so once I sort of came to that conclusion, I then thought, well, okay, well, what if they did bring it in and I had to buy an annuity? How would I do that? I mean, I'd look at a league table, and the league table, and it's sort of, there's some really perverse outcomes in the annuity market. So if it was compulsory for me to buy an annuity, I would have a look at the league tables. I'll be given a certain period of time to buy that annuity. I might have 6 months to buy it, so I'm sort of locked into the interest rate regime, so the pricing's pretty fixed. And there'll be a list of providers, and I'd look down that list of providers, and for the amount of money I want to put in, I could see, you know, which, you know, the AMP might be slightly more expensive than somebody else. There might, because of different, you know, could have different credit ratings and all that sort of thing. So what would be the criteria for me to select an annuity? And after thinking about it, there's no criteria other than buying the cheapest, buying the best return, irrespective of who underwrites it. And the reason for that is because if I paid a premium to go to an organisation that had a better credit rating because they had more capital backing their annuity, the day after I buy that annuity, they could sell it. They could sell that portfolio to another player in the market who's got a lot lower credit rating. They still meet the regulatory regime. They've still got the minimum capital adequacy. But I've actually got no choice. So once I've committed to this product, it's an irrevocable decision for me, both timing and institutionally, that now can get traded around the market. So if I was an investment banker, for example, and I wanted to set up an annuity provider and to sell it off, what I'd do is I'd sell a product that was just marginally below the price of everybody else. I'd get capital behind me. I'd buff it up. And then I go into the market, and if it's a sort of a heady market, then I'll get paid a good price for that. So effectively, you just become part of this trading mechanism. And there's a lot of responsibility on the regulator to regulate that. And there's no government guarantee. So I mean, when HIH went bust, there were people there who were getting pension benefits, and they lost their money. And whilst there's been no default of an annuity provider in Australia, the bet really is, and this is the point I made yesterday, is if I buy off of XYZ company, I'm betting that they're going to live longer than me because I don't know what's going to happen to my portfolio once I've bought it. And I'm a real sceptic when it comes to institutional integrity and everything else, because they go through periods, you know, they go ups and downs and everything else. And once you've made the irrevocable decision, you've really got no choice and you're relying on the government to regulate that market, and the government's not providing a guarantee. So that's sort of my aversion, I suppose, to annuity products. And so is there an alternative? Well, I've just summarised here briefly a couple of alternatives. One could be a term certain annuity. You know, it might be compulsory for me to buy a 30- or 40-year term certain annuity, which doesn't have the longevity issues attached to it. Sinking funds, sort of annuity drawdown proposal, that's a way of doing it. So there's no easy answer to this, but I suppose the bottom line from my perspective is there is no easy answer anyway. I think because we're looking at such long-term guarantees that we've got no control over those guarantees anyway. We might like to think that we can buy an annuity and that's going to lock us in for life, but depending on what happens in the economy and the individual companies, that's really open. And I'd much rather have the money under my control and have that control over it than hand it out to an institution. So there's two defining questions really in my mind. One question is, I don't think the government's got a role in making it compulsory for wealthy people to buy annuity products. That puts a lot of weight on the government to potentially underwrite those products if the annuity provider defaults or if the longevity increases. And the second defining question for me is, why would anybody want to buy a long-term annuity anyway if there's no real protection guarantee long term that's going to be there when you most need it? So that's my rant. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry. Look, given the interest in longevity issues that Henry devoted in his report, I think this is a very important contribution to the debate. So I think it's very well done. Now, it's interesting to note that Henry did make a comment in the final report in relation to support of the government annuity market. And in the week leading up to this presentation, I wrote to Barry saying, you're very lucky that Henry didn't rule out completely the case for the lifetime support of the government annuity market, because we wouldn't be talking about very much today. But what Henry did say, Henry effectively ruled out compulsory annuitisation. They said that wasn't preferred.
but they didn't rule out support for lifetime annuities. They commented that the government should assist the market by having relevant investment products. It talked about longevity hedging and some tax support for longevity products. And Henry also, in one of the recommendations, mentioned the possibility of a sale of a government annuity. So it's not off the table. The government hasn't responded to that, but the Henry report has put the idea firmly on the agenda. So do you agree with Barry's proposition? Do you agree that there's a case against a lifetime annuity market in Australia being supported by the government? Has Barry listed all of the reasons for and against? You might have some views, so I'll hand it over to you. Can you please just state your name and where you're from? Thanks.
My name is Brennick van Wyk. I'm from Q-Super, north of the Tweed. Barry, I don't agree with your statement that annuities would only be for the wealthy. With a reasonable or small amount of capital, you can buy an extra $100 a fortnight, which for somebody only in receipt of the age pension is relatively useful. Please comment on that.
That's true. That's right. You can. I'm not sure how much that would cost and how efficient that would be, but I think the figures I had in here from the Sheriff's paper, which may be slightly different now, and the way I read them was that a person age 67 getting a lifetime annuity, inflation adjusted, was about 6% return. So for every $100 I paid, I'd get a pension of $6. So how much would you need to pay to get $100 a week? So that's $5,000 a year, isn't it? So that's $300,000, $400,000, I'd imagine, at least. I don't know. I mean, people could have the choice of that. And I suppose what I'm saying is it shouldn't be a compulsory choice. It would be a choice that person makes based on advice. But if you were to make it compulsory, then that $300,000 would need to be on top of some other fixed lump sum asset they've got of maybe $500,000 or $600,000. So you're still looking at somebody who's retiring with a nest egg of $1 million, aren't you? If you were looking at the government setting up a rule to make it compulsory, they couldn't make every dollar that you had above a base amount of nothing almost to go into a compulsory annuity. You'd expect to have some buffer there. So for a pension of $100 a week, I couldn't imagine the government would make that compulsory unless you've got at least $1 million in a nest egg somewhere. I don't know.
Andrew McKee, Australian Unity. I just want to pick up on some of those points. In terms of the compulsory nature from dollar zero, it would be a pretty brave move for a government to try and introduce that. It would be a sure way to get voted out, I would think, and At the end of the day, politicians are politicians, so I can't see them doing that. And also on that wealth question, you talked about sort of potentially $3 or $4 million people might need to have. In that category, they're the people who aren't going to run out of capital. Longevity risk for those people is less material, and they're really thinking about passing on their wealth to the next generation. So it's the middle ground that are more at risk. I think if people got $3 or $4 million, $5 million, they're the ones that aren't going to run out of capital.
Yeah, my calculation was wrong, wasn't it? I'd multiplied, not divided. So what? It's maybe about 60,000, isn't it? For 100,000, yeah, for 100,000, that's right. You could buy $100 a fortnight. That's right. Yeah, but there'd still be that trigger point, wouldn't there? Of, as you say, the minimum amount that the government needs to say, you'd still be $1 million, I'd say, but you'd be paying $100,000 for $100 a week pension based on that calculation.
Rizwan Ali from ING. Having heard about all these uncertainties, is it perhaps more appropriate to focus back on the individual and give them as much information as you can, you know, standardized projections and so on, in terms of what they might accumulate and what they would need to accumulate, so they can perhaps make their own best choices as to how they should go? I mean, the uncertainty certainly seem to be formidable.
Yeah, I mean, that's really how the market works now, isn't it? It's people have got reasonably full disclosure. But maybe that's why not many people are buying annuities. So, and I know I've spoken to financial planners. In fact, when this went up on the website, some financial planner called me up, which is a bit of a shock for me because I don't normally talk to financial planners. And we actually had a session in his office where I had a workshop, and he called. You know Andrew Wakeling, and he knows Ian Lachlan. Where's Ian? I think it was, I can't remember. And so we went into his office and had a workshop on the whole thing. And because what he'd said about the systemic risk is that what you do there is you just buy products from three or four annuity providers, and that would sort of overcome that, which is true. But there's obviously fixed and variable costs in that, so I'm not sure how efficient that would be. So what he, as a financial planner, was looking for was providing people with all the information they need, but then trying to lock in some minimum. And he was an advisor to wealthy clients. His argument would be that they should probably put $1 or $2 million or something in an annuity product, spread it between three or four different providers, and then that provides a base load of income. And they've got assets they can run off of that, which is true. But I'm not sure how much of a... I mean, the person can do that anyway now, but there's only one annuity provider. And the reason there's only one annuity provider is because it's not perceived to be a market. But I know there's new... I mean, I know your company's now organising annuity products, and AXA, I think, and some other people. That's not a compulsory market, is it? That's just the market working. And there are certainly some things the government could do to make that market more efficient. There's regulatory issues, there's tax issues, which aren't skewing the market towards annuities, but it's just sort of removing a few of the barriers that are there, and I think they should be removed. But it's not making it compulsory. So I'm all for open markets, but just not compulsory markets. I suppose the interesting question about the various annuity providers that are coming out now is that some of them aren't actually providing it on life office balance sheets. I'm not sure of the detail. I'm not an expert in this, but I know some of them are using hedging techniques in the market rather than capital techniques on the balance sheet. So there's different sorts of systemic risks actually that are going to come through. Some will survive some sort of downturns and not others, and others will survive and those won't. So maybe that's another way of getting around it. But I don't know if any amount of disclosure... I don't know if disclosure works. I mean, I'm also a default type product person, but certainly when you get a lot of money and if you're wealthy, then you do need full disclosure. But then the market works. That's how the market is all about. As long as it's disclosed, like going into a casino, as long as you know, they should have a probability thing on the board. This is what the probability of you losing is tonight. They should have the same with annuity products.
Barry, can I just ask a question? Do lifetime annuity markets work if there's no government support?
Well, I don't know how the UK market works, so I don't know. It'd be interesting to hear a comment, because apparently they've got quite a good market, a well-developed market in the UK. And they have an impaired lives market, I think, too, in the UK. So it'd be interesting to get some feedback on that. Maybe the issue in Australia is we're just not big enough. Anybody know the UK market?
Duncan Rawlinson. I'll just talk to that, but I wouldn't mind coming back a bit later on when others have had a chance to ask some questions with another one of my own. But there's a lot of, to my mind, misconception around the UK market. I've not been there for some while, but I do keep tabs with it, and I was deeply involved in some of this when I was there. The UK market is generally talked about as a compulsory market for annuities. That's not strictly true anymore, or at least it's only partially true. And so if you went back far enough, and that might be 15 years or so, depending for the majority of people, depending what scheme you... It did depend a bit what scheme you were in, and obviously people in DB employer funds, they had their issue taken care of anyway. But if you were coming into what you can think of as the equivalent of compulsory SG... in private pension arrangements in the UK, for which you got generous tax breaks, when you retired, at the point of retirement, you had to buy a lifetime annuity. No ifs, buts, or maybes. That has been relaxed progressively over time, but it does mean there are two very different markets in the UK. There's a compulsory annuity purchase market, and there is a voluntary annuity purchase market. The experiences of those two markets are very different. There isn't a particularly deep and effective market, to my mind, in the voluntary annuity space. Generally, it's been, well, by definition, there has been quite a deep and seen as successful, at least from a provider point of view, market for in the compulsory annuity space. But even there, clearly, providers have taken varying degrees of baths on the assumptions that they've made in light of subsequent mortality improvements. But even that market's moved on a lot. So it used to be the case at point of retirement you had to buy a compulsory annuity. You don't have to do it anymore. You can go instead into the equivalent of an allocated pension. But when you get to age 75 now in the UK, you have to, at that point, have purchased a lifetime annuity, unless there's another carve-out that you can do something which was prompted by religious objectors. But there's a kind of there's a thing on the margin. I wouldn't suggest focusing on it, but it is no longer the case that at point of retirement it's your only choice is to purchase a compulsory annuity. The reason why I think that's interesting is because despite those rules having been relaxed now for best part of 15 years, if you look at the sales stats, still the majority are buying compulsory annuities at retirement, not buying the equivalent of allocated pensions or third-generation products. So you've got to ask yourself, well, why might that be? And I think there are a number of drivers, some of which are kind of legacy issues for the UK market. But I guess my observation would be it is very... I'd caution against trying to draw too many parallels between the two markets without a good understanding of what's driving purchase at retirement in the UK, and particularly some of the selling regulations that sit behind that might drive preference for certain products there compared with what we're used to seeing in this market.
But are you saying that the non-compulsory market is a viable market?
My personal view is no. I think the questions that's been asked before is would we see a strong, burgeoning, vibrant lifetime annuity market in Australia without compulsion? Personally, I doubt it. I think there's too much baggage and too many other reasons for people to look for alternative solutions. That doesn't mean to say that I don't think they've got a place, and certainly I think Nick Khalil and I cover a bit of that a bit later on in our session.
But would you buy one?
Yeah, I would. But I guess my observation, at the risk of this turning into a contrary rant, Barry, is that I think one of the things that irritates me is that I think some of these assessments are actually quite simplistic. Compulsion could mean a range of things, yeah. And I don't want to sit here and suggest I'm an absolute advocate for compulsion. I'm not. I think there are strong arguments for it, and there are strong arguments against it. But it doesn't. If you're going to buy an annuity, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to buy. And most who are proposing, I don't believe, are proposing that you have to buy it necessarily at the point of retirement. Nor necessarily do you have to commit your entire retirement balance to it. So, I mean, I think challengers are certainly been quite open with a proposition of, well, actually, if you think about lifetime annuity as taking the place of part of your defensive portfolio in retirement. I think that's quite an interesting way of looking at things. The issues are, I think, are deserving of I think they're a complex set of issues, and I think there's a risk that looking at choices too superficially of it's either this or that risks simplifying the issue too far, I think. But I'll stop there and let some others speak.
Thanks, Duncan. And of course, in Australia, we did have government support for lifetime annuities until effectively Better Super came along. We had concessional arrangements for Social Security for lifetime annuities, and the RBLs, the maximum limits for super, were doubled if you took a lifetime annuity. So that withdrawal of those two provisions, it's argued, had a dramatic effect on the annuity market. So, any other?
Richard Cornwell, MLC. When I've been thinking about annuities lately, I've It seems to me that a lot of the time we talk about annuitisation at too young an age, and that annuities are probably more useful at older ages when there's more of a genuine insurance component, because it seems that for annuities at age 65, the mortality is not that uncertain, so the capital costs and uncertainties about mortality improvement tend to mean they're not very attractive. But if you sort of start looking at them more from 75 or 80, or even potentially deferred annuities, cutting it at 85 or something, which is when the people really might start running out of money, that's potentially a more useful part. It's one of the attractions, I guess, of the sort of GMWB products that are coming out, is that they're effectively a contingent annuity that pays out in the combination of poor investment performance and longevity, which is sort of where you need the payout. Just wondering your thoughts.
What are those products?
The ING products, the sort of Money for Life, the guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit products,
right?
Like Money for Life, and I believe AXA's announced its North version today. But
I haven't seen the pricing. I don't know.
Yeah, they're
much.
very subject to the pricing, but
yeah. Where's the risk carried?
They're carried by the life companies. The mortality risk is covered through the life company, and they hedge the market risk.
Because one of the points I make in the paper is that if you're buying generic type lifetime annuities, then the only criteria is really price, which encourages product complexity. So that's the difficulty in my mind, is that if you make it compulsory, then you're actually moving towards an environment where you're encouraging product complexity. And I know some of those products have actually already gone through one or two generations. They've only just got out. So we're sort of building a whole legacy issue, because like a bit like the fashion industry, you've got a whole legacy, wardrobe full of old clothes that the insurer's got to manage. So I'm not sure whether that's an issue or not. But
One issue that I think it argues against lifetime annuities given by an insurance company is that nobody likes the money being left with the insurance company. They don't think of it going to other beneficiaries who have bought annuities. They think that, oh, if I die early, the insurance company gets the money. One way around that, which is actually good for institutions that have some sort of mutual nature to them, for example, the industry funds, is the possibility of setting up various forms of tontines, which do cover some of the longevity risk. Now, they're not an absolute answer to these things, but to a certain extent, I believe that that structuring a tontine, where being based on an industry fund, you can say, look, you're going into a tontine with like-minded people, and stressing the mutuality of it, could overcome a number of the trust issues, which I think really underlie a lot of the distaste for a lifetime annuity.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I want to join a club that would take me as a member. So, I mean, the issue with... I know, there are big issues with tontines, because how many members does it take? And I wouldn't want to be the first one in there, so I'd want to check out who was already there, and I just think it's just socially, there's just too many complexities around that. I know that there has been a proposition to do that. I think one of the providers in the market sort of set up like a tontine-type arrangement, so...
The Esteron product was a form of tontine, wasn't it?
Yeah. Where's that? What's...
The tontine of one.
And that was always a mutual life problem too, wasn't it? You'd want to be the actuary, that you would be the last person to leave, wouldn't you?
I'm Paul Swinhoe. I think the big advantage of annuities is that it puts your super on Viagra. It makes, and I'm sure you appreciate that, Barry, it makes your super last longer. And that's got to be a good thing for many, many people. I agree with a lot of your comments about the disadvantages of fixed lifetime annuities, and personally I'm a fan of a pooled approach. I don't like the term tontine because it sounds like it's closed to new members, but as actuaries we can work out the rules so that you can have a pooled approach that allows new members to be coming in. If there were tontines, I'd like to join the asbestos workers' tontine, please. which is a crude...
You have to work in the mine for a couple of years.
But that's too high a price. And that last point was really to illustrate it'll only work if there's one pool across all of Australia. That as soon as you start having different pools, then people will be looking for the pool that suits them best. And so a government-sponsored pooled approach, which doesn't mean the government takes any risk, it doesn't mean that the government actually has your hands on any money, but the government facilitates the transfer of money from those who have died to those who are living longer, is a way that I could see it work. I'd also refer you to Hazel's McNeely's comments earlier, where she lauded the Singapore approach. They do run a pooled scheme now. She also criticised the investment approach, and it wouldn't translate directly to Australia. But if you're interested, have a look at that.
I've got to take out the Viagra point. I mean, I can't see... I mean, that sounds good, but I can't see how that works. I can't see how... Because who... I'm transferring a capital, a major capital asset to an insurer to underwrite volatility of risk, and so therefore the return I get is less than I would have got. I mean, it only works if I live a very long time. Okay, so if I live anything other than a very long time, I'm not on Viagra at all. So it just seems that it sounds like a good catchphrase, but I just can't see how... There's a price I'm paying for that. And I guess that's why, individually, I think people... That question of disclosure, people need to be aware of what that price is that they're paying and the risks they're taking with that money. I mean, that capital could disappear. Sorry. Somebody could hide my Viagra.
Barry, Margaret Bishop from BNP Paribas. I just wanted to take you up on the comment you made quite near the start that as you get older, you need less money. And I agree with you, you're probably not taking your overseas trips and so on. But there's definitely what happens as you get older is your risk of something going wrong and you needing money goes up. So perhaps there's a need for insurance policies as part of an annuity to cope with that. I mean, I know quite a few old people who have, and I'm talking in their 90s, who have a large need for money, who have actually got quite good pensions in some cases from previous good government super plans, which don't exist anymore, and are still struggling, you know, because of the cost of aged care or because they've got Alzheimer's and need help or even just because they're living at home and can't do their cleaning anymore. My view is that it's always better to have more money than you need than suddenly find out you've got less.
No, I mean, that argument can blow everything I said out the water because the whole health issue, in a way, has got... with the health costs run inversely to the income need. So if you actually tracked what I'd need to spend to enjoy myself at 90 versus what I need to spend to make sure I have a healthy life and medical costs, that actually goes the other way. So what I'm trying to assume here is I'm just talking about disposable income to live rather than the health issue, which I think is a completely different debate. And currently it's covered, you know, we've got our private health insurance schemes and all that sort of stuff. And I can understand what you're saying because that doesn't cover medical costs. So and there's this whole disability task force that's happening now that's looking into those sorts of questions. So I've ignored that, which is probably the wrong thing to do. So you're right.
Duncan.
I think a similar point. I think both that point and Barry, your earlier comment, to my mind, it's mixing up two very different problems. I mean, the issue is not an investment issue in retirement. It's an insurance issue for the reason you said. For, you know, the individual faced with either self-insuring and the consequences of all that and the uncertainties around it, or taking an alternative. And you see this in a number of different parts of perhaps the health spectrum, particularly. I mean, long-term care. You know, people will talk about that in different ways. Some will see it, the way they will describe it, they talk about it as an investment problem, and it's not. It's an insurance problem. And I think, you know, whether you sort of have concerns over things like annuities and surrendering your assets or subjecting them to the counterparty risks of an insurer. Yes, those are all relevant questions, but the fundamental is rationale for purchasing one, it seems to me, is an insurance proposition first and foremost. It's not an asset management problem directly.
I think that's right, but I just don't think that a lifetime annuity is the answer to that. I just think there's got to be another way of finding an answer to that other than buying or being forced to buy to pass your estate across to an insurer that can then trade that estate to whomever it wants to without a government guarantee on it.
Saffron Sweeney from Aon Consulting. One thing that I don't think anyone's discussing is the fact that superannuation has tax concessions so that people can save for retirement and use it in retirement. And I think it's interesting to see that we've got a compulsory market to save for retirement, but there's no way of assisting people in using that wisely or somehow, you know, in compulsorily asking people to keep it for retirement, not for kids or for these massive holidays if it's outside of their general means. I think we need to consider that the super money is for retirement. It's not for having a one big holiday or inheritance. And that's why maybe having government support or encourage annuities by the government a bit further would be important consider.
That's right. It's actually perverse, our system. We've got lots of rules and regulations about the money going in. But as soon as you hit that retirement age, it's almost tax-free and you can take it out as you want to. And you can argue that there's a component of that that's community money because you were given a tax deduction. I mean, you've been supported on the way through. It's 100% right. I don't think that giving that asset to a private sector organisation to trade around the market's the answer. I think it's more, I mean, there are ways of doing it, like just restricting how much you can take out. I mean, I'm sure that will happen eventually, that if you retire with a lump sum above a certain amount, there will be rules about how you can take that out, which I think as it should be. I completely agree with that. We just seem to have got to a position where you can haul all this money away, even if you're not getting a tax deduction for the money going in. If you can put the after-tax money in there, you're still getting a tax benefit because it's accumulating at lower interest, at lower tax rates. So, there is a community issue here, a community question. And I think that, but I don't think giving it to the private sector and taking a risk on it is the answer, because the government's going to end up paying for that. If the industry goes bust throughout, there's going to be pushback on the regulator, and so the industry will get the benefit of any upside. But if the industry collapses, then the question is, do the public then have to support that industry again, those people again, to get a double whammy?
Andrew Boll at the back, and before you ask a question, Andrew, can I put you on the spot and ask you, should the government sell annuities?
Yeah, thanks for that, Darren. Andrew Boll. There's one word answer to that question, I think, is probably no. Although the Institute did put a submission in to Henry around a deferred age pension, which has some other policy attributes to it as well, such as positively encouraging people to remain in the workforce after age 65 and defer use of their retirement capital until a bit later and getting adequately rewarded for doing so rather than feeling aggrieved at giving up their God-given right to the age pension from exactly on their 65th birthday and feeling like they have to retire to get it. And I guess I'll adjust my other comment based on that just last discussion around drawing down money post-retirement. I think the experience that I've seen and heard in discussions with others in the industry has been that people tend to draw down their savings more slowly than necessary in retirement rather than waste it in lump sums up front. So the actual behaviour is more conservative rather than more aggressive than what we're discussing here. And I guess what we need to think about is what members need rather than what we as actuaries and our clients want to provide. But what do the members actually need? And one of the biggest risks is at what level of income will they be extremely unhappy in retirement. Now, for some people, the age pension will provide, will be with the age pension alone, they may not be extremely unhappy, and that provides them with a base. But for others, it might be $3,000 or $4,000 more than just the age pension. And so when you get to age 91, 93, 95, and that's you've dropped back to the age pension, well, how do we have a product that says no matter how long you live, you'll never get to the income level where you're extremely unhappy? And I think that's where the role of annuities can come in, to secure that level of income. And if we don't provide those sorts of products, we'll end up in a system where the people draw down the money even slower to avoid that extreme unhappiness in retirement, and that will be more inefficient than an inefficient annuity. Any thoughts?
I'll take that as a statement.
I think so.
I think you're right. I think people will be risk averse in drawing down their money, and it seems as though the behaviour, as you say, is that people will not blow the money. They'll just, I mean, my mum and dad are the same. They haven't got much money, and they're going without. And in my mind, they should be spending up. You know, I can work at, you know, I know how old they are, and I know how much they should be spending, but they're not. They're just, and so what's going to happen is that's going to fall across down the, you know, down the estate chain. And if they were getting a lifetime pension, then presumably they would be spending as they went.
We've probably got time for one last question.
Very quick point. Nick Khalil from Watson Wide. Towers Watson, thank you. two very quick points. One, just to reinforce, I personally share all the same problems with the government mandating annuities that you've raised, Barry, but I think, you know, the counter to that in my mind, the strongest counter is that, I mean, ultimately, if we jump forward 20 years, I don't think it's an issue just of tax concessions, and so that gives the government the right. Even if there were no tax concessions, I mean, ultimately, if this is a problem in 20 years' time that people are, you know, falling below the poverty line in retirement, then the government, whether it's just by upping the age pension, will have massive pressure to act. So, to my mind, the social sort of imperative for the government to look after this massive bulge of people, whether or not they provided tax concessions along the way, at least gives some, you know, basis for the government doing something very unpopular. I don't think they necessarily will do that, but it to my mind, that pushes it the other way, that there is an argument that this should be done, even if, you know, annuities are not the right product for a lot of people, were they to choose them themselves. I mean, I fully agree with that, but maybe there's an overriding objective anyhow that means that they have to act in any regard, because 20 years down the track there'll be a time bomb exploding.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that there shouldn't be a lifetime annuity market. I think there should be. I think people should be able to buy into that market, and it should be an efficient market. I just don't think the government should be making it compulsory, because the way that the only options I can see that would happen would be is that that's going to end up costing the poor people in their taxes to subsidise the wealthy. Now that's how I see the thing. If you look at a 30 or 40 or 50 year time frame, that's the reason I'm saying it shouldn't be compulsory, is because it's going to fall over in a period of 50 or 60 years at least once, and it's going to end up in costing whoever's the taxpayer at that time money to subsidise the wealthy, who should have been looking after themselves anyway. When I started doing philosophy, I mean, anybody who's known me a while, I was sort of a raving neoliberal before I did philosophy. Now I'm at university doing this now, I'm sort of a social democrat. So I'm sort of moving slowly to the left in my views on these things.
Okay, well, I said one last question, but I think we can have another one last question. So, Michael.
Michael Bird. Barry, I think you're possibly working on a false assumption that the only form of annuity is a guaranteed term annuity, and when I've terms rather than term. And of course, they do represent quite poor value for money, because they're actually very difficult business for insurance companies to write. Not only have you mentioned the longevity issue, but the other main issue that insurance companies got is the reinvestment risk. Because you can't buy bonds of long enough term to match the liabilities. So you actually have to factor in that when the bonds come up for redemption, that you have to reinvest them, and you don't know what you'll be able to reinvest, at what rate you'll be able to reinvest And that's a real problem. Duncan will probably correct me if I've got it wrong, but in the UK, you can actually buy with-profits annuities. And effectively what you have there is a mixture of fixed interest and other investments. Now, you get a lower annuity amount to start with, but with every expectation that it will increase over time and that you will get the benefit of a better than fixed interest return over the term of the product, but not guaranteed. And I think that might get round part of your problem, because I get the impression you're somewhat adverse to them, because effectively you're saying they represent poor value for money, and part of that poor value for money is the investment strategy that's being used. So I think there are other ways of dealing with the issue that you're concerned about, and I think you need to think possibly a little bit more widely than fixed term, as in fixed terms and conditions annuities.
Yeah, you're right. That avoids the timing risk I was talking about, doesn't it? That goes part of the way, but it's just a product complexity, and I think the market can. Well, if we haven't got a deep market in what we've got now, then adding more complexity is going to make it a thinner market because people have more choice. I don't know.
Okay, well, unfortunately we've run out of time, but I thought that was a good discussion, and unfortunately we missed out on hearing about Paul's Viagra answer, but maybe over a cup of tea later on. But please thank Barry Rafer for an important contribution to the debate.